What's at stake for the progressive movement in the 2020 election?
Without the Democratic space to be able to organize and contend for political power, the prospects for building the kind of movement that can eventually lead and govern the country from a radical point of view are very small. So the defense of democratic rights and maximum democratic space is part of our tasks, although that in itself does not solve the underlying socioeconomic political economy problems that we're facing.
That's Max Elbaum. We talk with him about his article, Should Anti-Capitalists Urge a Vote for Joe Biden to Defeat Donald Trump in 2020? That's on the menu for this edition of What You Need to Know, a web-only extra on writersvoice.net. I'm producer and host, Francesca Rhiannon. On the left, a great debate is raging between progressives whose first priority is defeating Trump and those in the Never Biden camp. The former say that defeating white supremacist authoritarian control of the executive branch and the Supreme Court are necessary to protect the growing progressive movement. The latter say there's little difference between corporate Democrats on the one hand and the GOP and Trump on the other. And besides the Never Bidens claim, fighting Trump will strengthen the progressive movement. Meanwhile, Trump's main targets, Black, Latinx, and Muslim Americans, as well as immigrants, have a credible fear of ever more brutal persecution if Trump gets another term. Those are the stakes my guest Max Elbaum lays out in his post on the website Organizing Upgrade. Should anti-capitalists urge a vote for Joe Biden to defeat Donald Trump in 2020? Max Elbaum is the author of the 2018 book Revolution in the Air, 60s Radicals Turn to Lenin, Mao, and Che. Max Elbaum is the administrator of the left website Organizing Upgrade and the author of Revolution in the Air, 60s Radicals Turn to Lenin, Mao, and Che. Welcome, Max Elbaum, to Writer's Voice.
Well, thanks very much, Francesca.
So in the interest of full disclosure, you and I have known each other since the 1970s, 1960s even possibly, the end of the 60s. We were both students in the glory days of the movement in Madison, Wisconsin.
Yes, that was a really exciting time. And the bonds formed between activists then have lasted a long time, including ours.
That's for sure. I wanted you to come on to the show to talk about, well, you've written a number of things, but I really want to focus on what I think is possibly one of the best, if not the best, article about the whole should socialists support Biden debate. It's called Should Anti-Capitalists Urge a Vote for Joe Biden to Defeat Donald Trump in November 2020 or Not? And this appeared on the website Organizing Update. So before we kind of dive into the article itself, just give us a brief description. Tell us what Organizing Update is all about.
Organizing Upgrade has been around for a little more than a decade. But this is a second iteration of the project started in 2017. It's a group of activists from different parts of the country and different social movements, although primarily rooted in the racial justice and community organizing world, and came together to have a website that would discuss political strategies for those sectors of the movement and beyond. In non-electoral work, grassroots organizing, as well as electoral work, with a focus on centering racial justice, fighting the right wing, and building a durable, long-term progressive movement that takes up all the struggles for economic justice, gender justice, peace, and international solidarity. It's not connected to any particular political organization, but we identify with the broad current of the community organizing world, Movement for Black Lives, Working Families Party, Black Voters Matter, those kinds of organizations, and have published different things covering their work over the last period.
So you start out talking about how the 2020 election is going to determine which force is going to hold governing power. What are the two forces that you see as being in battle at this point?
The country right now seems polarized more so than at any time, certainly since the 60s when we were active, but arguably since the period of the Civil War. The polarization is a partisan political polarization, a racial polarization, a geographic polarization, and even a basic information polarization, as the different sides get their facts and interpretations from almost two different information systems. And I would describe the polarization as between the bloc united behind Donald Trump that's pushing a racist authoritarian agenda, and a much more diverse but larger anti-Trump majority that has different forces, but all for different reasons, see Trump as an existential threat to their interests, and for the progressive wing of the anti-Trump coalition as the main obstacle to advancing the kind of radical social change, structural change, that's needed in the country and that's been especially revealed as important because of the pandemic and more recently the uprising to defend Black lives.
So these two forces, one is being driven by white supremacy, the other has is united by its anti-Trumpism, and that anti-Trumpism is about what you're saying here, is about not only supporting racial justice, whatever that may mean. It may mean quite different things within that coalition, but also more broadly to protect some democratic norms. Is that correct?
Yes. The interrelationship between the struggle for democratic space, maximum democratic rights, and the struggle for social change and radical socioeconomic change, that's always been a very controversial issue on the left, but they're very interrelated. Without the democratic space to be able to organize and contend for political power, the prospects for building the kind of movement that can eventually lead and govern the country from a radical point of view are very small. So the defense of democratic rights and maximum democratic space is part of our tasks, although that in itself does not solve the underlying socioeconomic, political economy problems that we're facing.
Yeah, and so I'd like to talk next about kind of the two wings of the progressive movement, both of which came together behind Bernie's campaign. And before we get into their reaction to Biden, first, talk a bit about what Bernie's movement did accomplish, and then what it didn't, what it left undone.
Well, Bernie's campaign in 2016, which built upon Occupy and the concept of the 1%, the 99% versus the 1%, built on some of the momentum that the Black Lives Matter movement had, the climate movement, the climate justice movement, that put radical ideas onto the agenda. And his campaign in 2020 took them even further. So Bernie's campaign centered around economic justice, Medicare for all, a lot of ideas that were considered radical or marginal back even 5 years ago have become mainstream. As Bernie put it, he won the ideological fight within the Democratic Party in the primaries this year, although he lost the electability fight. But the whole tenor of the conversation around healthcare, around a Green New Deal, around racial and gender justice, even around somewhat around foreign policy, although that's been a weaker front of the resistance, Bernie deserves a lot of credit. And his campaign, with the spirit of not me, us, was a big factor, not only in changing the discourse, but in bringing a lot of candidates into politics, particularly women of color, who've been elected now to all levels, city council, state legislatures, the squad in Congress, and now the squad expanding in size, Cori Bush's victory in St. Louis, other important victories in New York and other states. So the landscape has changed, and Bernie's campaigns have a substantial credit for that. There were shortcomings in Bernie's campaigns, and so he wasn't perfect, but we don't expect perfection. He made things a lot better, and he's playing a very crucial role right to this moment, focusing on the kind of relief that's needed under COVID-19, as well as the electoral struggle in November.
We're talking with Max Elbaum of Organizing Upgrade about his article, Should Anti-Capitalists Urge a Vote for Joe Biden to Defeat Donald Trump in November 2020 or Not? So talk about these two wings of, let's say, the Democratic Socialist with a small DS, not big DS, you know, people who identify as Democratic Socialists, but not necessarily with the Democratic Socialists of America, DSA. And talk about the two wings, those who are working within an anti-Trump coalition to fight for a greater influence of progressive programs, working class oriented programs, a multicultural working class movement, and those who say you can't cooperate with electoral politics in the U.S. because these are just two wings of the corporate class.
Well, Bernie's campaign, and let's approach that via the differences that existed within Bernie's campaign and then what sort of popped out as soon as Bernie withdrew. Most people who supported Bernie's campaign, the broad mass, were excited about his program. Medicare for All, Green New Deal, Not Me, Us, and his critique of the establishment, his critique of the injustices within the system, you know, especially since the economic crisis of 2008 and the bailouts and all that. But for socialists and for people who were anti-capitalist within Bernie's campaign, people looked at it in two different ways, and Bernie sent some mixed signals. So, you know, part of his campaign was railing against the billionaire class and the establishments in both parties. And it seemed from that there were sectors of the socialist, democratic socialist movement that saw Bernie as running basically against the establishments equally of both parties. The fact that he was running for the Democratic Party nomination was just a temporary tactical thing, and that perhaps Bernie himself or a large section of his base would break off from the Democrats and form a new party if he didn't get the nomination. The other signal was sent by Bernie's constant refrain that Trump was the most dangerous president in modern American history, that defeating Trump was essential, and that he would support whoever the nominee in the Democratic Party was in order to beat Trump. And those socialists who identified with that point of view and saw that signal were essentially thinking in terms of an anti-fascist front. One can discuss the language about whether Trump is a fascist or an authoritarian racist or, you know, exactly what that is. But that particular wing of the socialist movement and Bernie's signal was that we would be part of a broader coalition where we would have to unite with forces that we don't agree with on the long-range strategy that would be our enemies somewhere down the road. But under the current set of circumstances, it was essential to eliminate the main obstacle to any kind of social change, climate change denialism, white nationalism, having its grip on executive power. And those two points of view could pretty easily coexist within Bernie's campaign while it was a live campaign, because we all supported Bernie Sanders. And we were critical of Biden and the other candidates from the so-called moderate or corporate wing of the Democratic Party. And we were pushing for Bernie to get the nomination and lead the struggle in 2020. And there was a lot of excitement after Nevada that Bernie won, and it looked like he was the front runner. And things went downhill very quickly in South Carolina and on Super Tuesday. And Bernie was pretty much pushed to the bottom and out of the race. And at that point, the different socialist interpretations of what a correct strategy would be of how to move forward in 2020 all popped to the surface. And the debate started to come out, and not always in the best way, because people were still reeling from trying to absorb what had happened about how a campaign that was a front-runner campaign just in a matter of weeks could crash. So those two ideas clashed. And Bernie himself moved very quickly, became clear that his point of view was to be part of an anti-right-wing, anti-Trump front. He endorsed Biden. He set up joint task forces with Biden and began to try to influence the direction of the campaign and made an agreement with Biden that Biden would allow him to play some role in shaping his Biden administration policies. And so the forces who were in that camp in the socialist movement had a fairly smooth transition to figuring out, throwing themselves into the campaign against Trump and figuring out how to do their work in that campaign, not as part of Biden's official campaign, but setting up independent structures that would campaign to defeat Trump, but would bring the people that they would reach into the orbit of the progressive grassroots organizations that had a longer range view than just beating Trump and thinking everything would be okay. The other forces, the people who had a different point of view, had a more complicated dilemma because there was not a substantial move, given especially how dangerous people in the labor movement and the Black community saw Trump. There was no large-scale motion to break off from the Democrats and form a new party or support the Greens. So those folks more or less decided that they would put their energy into down-ballot races or non-electoral struggles, but sit out, take no collective position. Some individually would decide how they would vote, but take no collective position on the presidential contest.
I wonder what you think of the idea that possibly the Never Biden folks are misconstruing the stage of development of the left movement in this country. I mean, you and I are both old enough to remember when there was an ascendant left on the anti-war front, but then the many, many years of severe marginalization. I mean, I can remember when you couldn't even use the term capitalism without people looking at you as if you were some kind of communist. And now people are very comfortable talking, even in the mainstream, about neoliberalism. And the change in views on Black Lives Matter, for example, have been astonishing. As you pointed out, you know, the Overton window has really moved considerably to the left, but that's just one stage, a critical one. I mean, think how many decades it took the right wing to overtake the New Deal politics. I mean, decades of changing the ideological landscape. So I wonder if you could weigh in just on, you know, where are we in terms of power and the difference between ideological power and institutional power?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail right on the head. It's been a very fluid period, and there's certainly a radicalization, especially among young people. And all kinds of ideas are in the mainstream now that are more radical. And there's a tremendous sympathy for systemic change, or even under the name socialism, among new generations. But the institutional strength of those ideas, how much clout they can actually wield, how many voters they can mobilize, what institutional forms can they exercise power in, that lags behind. So it was a very interesting situation. Bernie's campaign ran way ahead of the underlying institutional infrastructure of the progressive and social justice movements, not to speak of the anti-capitalist left. So it wasn't a case, for example, where large socialist organizations or radical groups were driving the campaign and then they found a candidate who might support their points of view. It worked the other way. Bernie was way out ahead of where the institutional structure of the left was. And that's still the case. And that's the principal reason why Bernie didn't win the nomination, because even large numbers of people who supported his ideas did not believe that he was the most electable candidate, and their connections were still to the moderate wing, the establishment wing of the Democratic Party. Of course, the main example of that is African Americans in the South, who were decisive in South Carolina and on Super Tuesday in giving the nomination to Biden. That's the sector of the U.S. population that has the most vivid memory of Jim Crow. It has the most vivid memory of the civil rights movement and what gains were accomplished. And it's the sector of the U.S. population that's experienced the rollback in terms of the southern states' anti-union policies, anti-misogynistic, anti-reproductive rights policies, economic policies, as well as the direct racial policies. And that layer of the population is supportive of radical change, but very concerned with defeating Trump. And Bernie and the left was not a known factor in many of those communities, whereas they didn't know the more mainstream politicians, if you want to use that term, and Biden was a familiar face to them. So we lost that struggle, and it takes years, as you said, Francesca, it takes years to match radical ideas with the kind of infrastructure of grassroots organizations that can make you a political force. So the left has maybe a half a dozen to a dozen people in Congress now. We have people scattered in cities and state legislatures. We're even electing some district attorneys. But we're not a dominant force yet. And we have to take that into account when we look at what the stakes are with a white nationalist climate denialist reactionary who's now trying to destroy the post office and all that in the White House.
Yes, exactly. And of course, the other big thing is, you know, we can talk about how long it took the conservatives to gain that kind of institutional power. And what they had in their favor was the oligarchy. We're in a much more oligarchic situation now. So that the movement that we're talking about is not just fighting for recognition, let's say. I think it's been successful beyond my wildest dreams when it comes to recognition in such a swift time period. But it's also fighting against an entrenched ruling class that has only become more powerful in these decades. But you point to some splits in that ruling class. So I wonder if you could, first of all, talk about those splits and then how the left might be able to exploit them.
Well, the Trump administration has decided its fossil fuel backers. It's driven by the most reactionary sections of the ruling class, the fossil fuel industry, the military industrial complex, and the whole cohort of right-wing billionaires. And they built a social coalition based on the idea that white supremacy has to be reinforced because otherwise, the changing demographics of the country are going to remove them from power. I mean, Trump and the Republicans have explicitly said, if everybody gets to vote, we'll never win another election, which is why they're moving toward authoritarian rule and a sort of new form of apartheid, second-class citizenship for people of color, voter suppression, disenfranchisement, and all kinds of other things. So that coalition views a certain kind of authoritarianism as absolutely indispensable for their interests. Now, another wing of the ruling class doesn't agree with that. They think that that's highly unstable, that in the changing demographics, you can't build a stable ruling capitalist system based upon a narrow white base that has to be ginned up all the time into hatred and fear-mongering. They think it's the elimination of U.S. soft power around the world, as the U.S. has been able to position itself as a democracy, as for human rights, and so on. And they're also personally threatened by the kind of mafia-type state that Trump has been implementing. I mean, he wants to throw Hillary Clinton in jail. He wants to throw Jeff Bezos in jail. It's a totally corrupt type system where all the funds go to his cronies and so on. And he wants to intervene in the economy to favor not the capitalist class overall, but his particular favorites. And that's not a stable system. That's a sign of political weakness. So there's a section of the ruling class, but that for that mix of reasons, as well as some of them individually, are not happy with the extreme crudeness of the bigotry, homophobia, and so on of the Trump administration. So you see this incredibly bitter partisan battle. And that is an opening for us. You know, when a ruling class is united, they're very hard to defeat. But what you learn on the playground as a kid is you let your enemies fight, and you don't fight all your enemies at once if you want to survive in a difficult situation. So that division in the ruling class is something we can exploit. And especially now that we, per the last discussion we just had, we're certainly not a dominant force, but we're a rising force. More and more people are coming to support ideas. A lot of the dynamism and enthusiasm is with the progressive wing. So they've made some concessions. They've moved on to some issues. So we have some leverage that we didn't have before, and we have to use it as best we can, both to defeat the main enemy and to position ourselves so that we're stronger in the contention with people that we're now allied with but are going to be fighting against on January 21st. If Biden wins, we're going to have a complicated relationship where the Trump people aren't going to go away and we'll still have to fight them, but we'll also be fighting against the administration. As many people have said in elections in the United States, you get to pick your opponents. It's not that you're voting for people who are going to be our saviors, but you're getting to vote for who in the government is going to be your opposition. And who would you rather fight, the white nationalist authoritarians or people like Biden who have a different politic?
Yes, and you actually say that throwing ourselves into that anti-Trump coalition is the best route for building the strength of progressive movements and the socialist left. Tell us how we do that.
Well, you know, the largest number of people in our core constituencies that we have to reach to make social change, the African-American community, indigenous communities, other people of color communities, immigrant communities, the Latino communities, which are now the largest non-supposed racialized group in the United States. It's not white. The labor movement, women, young people, in largest numbers, those social sectors see Trump as a grave threat. In one of the seminars, webinars I saw the other day, Jessica Byrd from the Movement for Black Lives Electoral Justice Project, when asked about stance on the election, she said, well, what we've been hearing from black people is that Trump is going to kill us. Our lives are at stake. Mi Gente has one of the largest main organizations driving the Latino immigrant rights movement has a dump Trump campaign. This is a sentiment in that community. So if the left's message is, we're going to stand with you in that fight, we're going to be in the foreground of helping beat Trump, and we're going to go on from there, that's a message that resonates. If your message is, Biden isn't good enough for us, so we're sitting out the election. You all can go vote against Trump, but we're not going to spend any energy in that. We're going to come back into the fight when we have somebody we like better. That's not a message that's going to resonate with those constituencies. You know, Trump just invited those two people who brandished guns at the Black Lives Matter peaceful protest in St. Louis to speak at the Republican National Convention. So what signal is he sending? He's sending the signal, okay, you white homeowners in the suburbs, get your guns and get out there and be ready because the blacks are coming to take your house. This is straight out of Jim Crow. This is straight out of the Ku Klux Klan. Now, is our message going to be, we're against that. We got to get that out of office. It doesn't mean Biden is going to eliminate racism, but he's not going to be calling for white people to get their guns out and brandish them at peaceful protesters. So we need a message that talks about defeating Trump as being one stage of a longer struggle. And that's the message that the grassroots groups that have dug into electoral work in the last 4 or 5 years, Florida New Majority, Pennsylvania Stands Up, the Working Families Party, the different PACs and CPD Action, Center for Popular Democracy Action, People's Action, Black Voters Matter, Mi Gente. That's the message that these groups are sending, because it's in touch with where the base of progressive-minded people are at. And by throwing themselves into the fray, they're expanding their own base. They're not expanding the number of people who are joining Democratic Party clubs or signing up to give money to Biden. They're giving money and signing up to be members of those organizations that are committed to fighting for power on a state-by-state basis come after November and January.
Well, Max Elbaum, that is a great point to end on. Your article is, should anti-capitalists urge a vote for Joe Biden to defeat Donald Trump in November 2020 or not? I'd say that the answer to that is a ringing yes, but then the struggle continues. Thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me, Francesca. We've been together for 57 years, and let's hope we keep going and see some more victories.
Max Elbaum is the administrator of the left website Organizing Upgrade and the author of Revolution in the Air, 60s Radicals Turned to Lenin, Mao, and Che. You've been listening to a web-only extra in our What You Need to Know series on Writer's Voice. We'll be airing the interview in the radio space later in the season.